What's up out there, everybody? Welcome to Movies Never Say Die. This is Midnight at the Video Store, where the lights are low, the VHS tapes are dusty, and the carnage pops off the box art like a beacon light for those wanting some late night horror chaos. Today we're taking it back to the glorious 1980s, the decade when cult horror movies ruled the video store shelves, slasher flicks haunted every sleepover, and the scariest thing wasn't the monster in the movie as much as it was the monster in your mind when you tried to go to sleep after a snack-filled weekend movie marathon with friends. In this special Halloween edition, we're dusting off a stack of cult horror favorites that terrified, thrilled, and cracked us up in equal measure. To me, these are the kind of movies that you rented on a dare, possibly washed between your fingers as a teen, and definitely quoted for years. From creature features to campy gore, these are 80s horror classics that I think became midnight legends. So grab your membership card, dim the lights, and let's hit play on the 80s horror classics that I still love watching during the spooky season. Brain slugs crash a 50s prologue, then go on to infest an 80s college town, leaving Tom Atkins, Jason Lively, and Jill Whitlow to battle zombie frat boys in prom night doom in 1986's Night of the Creeps, a snappy sci-fi ghoul mashup where one detective's thrill me motto becomes the night's battle cry for survival. The perfect way to kick off a Halloween binge, this movie, as cliche as it sounds, is Fred Dekker's love letter to late-night TV and drive-in schlock, topped off with brain slugs from space, zombie frat boys, a chainsaw cameo, and Tom Atkins growling thrill me like he's ordering black coffee with a side of doom. The tone here really is sweet spot cult status, self-aware without being smug, funny without winking itself into oblivion, and just gnarly enough to make you pull the blanket up to your chin while watching.
I got good news and bad news, girls.
What?
The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
I first saw this movie the way it begged to be seen, rented with friends, the lights off, cheap pizza, a bunch of Mountain Dew, and a rattly old VCR that would make itself part of the score. It really would become a Halloween sleepover staple for us, the kind of movie where you quoted lines for a week and suddenly everybody was thinking that trench coats were a personality trait. And as a kid, I loved the creature feature chaos, and as an adult, I really do admire how Dekker just stitches together genres nicely. It's 50s sci-fi with 80s campus comedy and Romero-flavored zombie mayhem that never loses its charm, all blended into a kick-ass goulash of horror cinema. Why is it a cult classic? Well, it certainly wasn't a box office monster, but on cable and on home video, it would find its people, fans who got the references, who adored Atkins, and who treated that finale like a rock concert encore. Fun fact about this movie, this was actually Dekker's first full feature. He'd then follow it up with directing The Monster Squad. He'd then pen the story for House 2, really cementing himself as the VHS patron saint for monster kids. And as for the pop culture imprint of Night of the Creeps, I think it lives on. Thrill me endures as a cult slogan. The brain slugs are oozed into horror comedy DNA, and the movie remains the blueprint for mixing nostalgia with midnight movie mischief. After a lightning strike fries the circuits of Park Plaza Mall, newly installed predator bots turn into kill-happy security guards, trapping party-ready teens inside, led by Kelly Maroney, Tony O'Dell, and Barbara Crampton, where suddenly the food court turns into a bloody battle zone of terror in Chopping Mall from 1986. If Night of the Creeps is the hook, Chopping Mall is the sugar rush. Pure food court terror. This was a repeat rental for me and my friends. Lights off, popcorn flowing, and everybody insisting on which store would be a totally safe bunker. The vibe here is just blissful VHS, 77 minutes, no fat, no gristle, and just enough mall after dark mischief to make you glance at the mannequins the next time you're at the mall.
Ready to pick us up one by one!
He ain't getting me.
Kelly Maroney makes for a perfect, resourceful lead. Barbara Crampton brings Scream Queen cred, and the robots, basically Roombas that join SWAT, zap, choke, and boom their way through glass and teenagers with deadpan authority. So it's easy to see why Chopping Mall is cult classic. It's the most 80s cocktail imaginable. Consumerism gags, synthesizer strings, laser-eyed murder droids, and a location that just really doubles as a time capsule. The Sherman Oaks Galleria setting just stamps it into pop culture geography. Same mall DNA as Fast Times, Commando, and later on Terminator 2. The humor's cheeky, the pace is relentless, and I think the practical explosions feel like a 4th of July inside of a frickin' Radio Shack. Fun fact about this movie, it was originally released as Killbots and it underperformed until being retitled Chopping Mall for home video, where it would find its forever home on the staff picks wall for years. Another nod here, Bartel and Warrenoff cameo as their Eating Raoul characters, really linking midnight movie universes together like a cult cinema crossover. Now, as for its pop culture imprint, it's cemented. The phrase, have a nice day, became a laser-punctuated catchphrase. The mall became a horror playground, and Winorski's bot-designed walks so future retail nightmares could run, where to survive the night, you didn't need a sleeping bag and a box of rubbers. You needed a propane tank and a frosty one-liner. When fuzzy alien convicts called Krites touch down on a Kansas farm, the Brown family, led by Dee Wallace, Billy Bush, and Scott Grimes, will fight back while shape-shifting bounty hunters, one wearing Terrence Mann's rock idol face, bring interstellar firepower in 1986's Critters, an extraterrestrial home invasion flick with a heavy side of fur. I first met the Krites on a sleepover double feature paired with a bunch of Nintendo games, where the pizza grease on my hands shined brighter than the moonlight on that farmhouse. Critters is comfort food creature mayhem. It's funny, it's fast, and sneakily heartfelt. The Brown family plays it straight while the movie just winks and lets the hairballs and insanity roll. Dee Wallace anchors the chaos. Scott Grimes sells kid-eyed bravery, and Terrence Mann's a bounty hunter morphing into rock idol Johnny Steele is peak VHS magic. What I love about it now is how Herrick balances jokes with stakes. The Krites are goofballs until they bear rows of teeth and razz a house like demonic tumbleweeds. Why Critters earns its cult status? I mean, New Line Cinema's Little Monsters lived on weekend cable, just building a fandom that quoted subtitled Krites speak and argued which bounty hunter face was cool. It's got that just delightful DIY spirit. Firecrackers, farmhouse ingenuities, and space shotguns solving problems that video store shelves seldom could.
Dad's all torn up and Mom's got like a harpoon thing in her neck and they're getting bigger.
Critters fun fact, the script was actually in development before Gremlins, and then the studio had to lean into the sci-fi angle and those bounty hunters to set it apart on video. I think for its pop culture imprint, I think it's really solidified as the box art that's more memorable than the movie. Terrence Mann's Power of the Night is a karaoke dare to this day. The rolling critter ball is a genre legend, and the movie spawned a mini franchise that would keep rental racks stocked well into the 90s. As for October marathons, it's the creature feature you show between heavier hitters, with crowd laughs guaranteed and bite marks optional. Here, a college heir, played by Peter Liapis, inherits a cobweb mansion, dabbles in occult rituals, and then unleashes pint-sized goblins who turn a house party into a satanic sideshow in Ghoulies from 1985, with Lisa Pelican and Michael DeBarres co-starring in Tiny Terror Chaos with notorious bathroom reputation. Now, this movie was usually the my older brother picked it rental, and as a kid, it looked so independent, it almost felt like it was an underground horror flick, the kind you weren't sure you were allowed to watch, which of course made it irresistible. I mean, Ghoulies is grimy, rubbery, altar basement horror that just smells like candle wax and spilt Jolt Cola. Ghoulies is sleazy cute, satanic cosplay meets Looney Tunes chaos, and watching it now, I still dig the punky ambition.
Yeah.
I got an idea. Let's do a ritual.
Yes, the plot is wobbly at best, but the miniature monster gags, the sorcery vibes, and Jack Nance wandering through like he took a wrong turn from Eraserhead just gives the movie endless personality. I mean, why Ghoulies earns its cult status? Naturally, because of that infamous toilet poster. Overnight, bathrooms became boss levels and home video did the rest. I mean, this movie lived in the $2 for $3 section at the video store and it turned into a dare movie at sleepovers. It's far less polished than most of its creature contemporaries, but that roughness is where the charm is found. Fun fact about Ghoulies, the marketing pivoted hard into the toilet gremlin imagery, which actually wasn't a huge part of the movie at all, but it burned itself into rental era memory and into the nightmares of anybody mid-flush. As for its pop culture imprint, I mean, the porcelain jump scare became shorthand for VHS nastiness, and Ghoulies helped cement the tiny terrors subgenre that ruled discount racks. It's perfect for October filler when you want cackles with your horror. Just bring a plunger and a sense of humor. Two suburban kids played by Stephen Dorff and Lewis Tripp crack open a backyard pit and accidentally invite a demon dimension in to crash the weekend in The Gate from 1987, a movie that's just fueled on heavy metal lore, stop-motion minions, and best friend bravery as a house is turned into a siege movie for monster kids. I grew up in the soggy Pacific Northwest, and after catching this movie on cable, I immediately checked my backyard woods for any suspicious geodes. The Gate is sleepover gold, kid-scale horror with legit scares, tiny rubber demons that swarm like nightmare M&Ms, and eyeball in a hand gag and stop-motion set pieces that still rule to this day. As a kid, the play-the-record-backward plot hook felt pleasantly forbidden, and as an adult, I love how this movie never talks down to its audience. The kids are capable, the house becomes a battleground, and the FX team just milks forced perspective and suit actors into uncanny perfection. Why it earns its cult real estate? Well, The Gate just hit that perfect middle lane. It was too intense for kiddie fare, too playful for hardcore gorehounds, so it lived just forever on TV and on tape, passed down like a campfire story, and it's the rare gateway horror that you can revisit without the irony.
You got demons.
My friends and I loved this movie, even though most of their older siblings thought it was too cheesy. And a fun fact about The Gate, many of the minions are actually full-size performers in suits, filmed with giant props, and then composited into the image. It's practical wizardry that just gives the creatures weight you can feel. And as for its pop culture imprint for 80s kids, this movie made heavy metal album arts feel like a user manual. And for Halloween lineups, it was a total watch in the dark movies, all lined up on the couch with your buddy. In this one, a midnight museum lures Zach Galligan, Deborah Foreman, and friends into these exhibits that come alive, trapping them inside its monster world in 1988's Waxwork, a horror thrill ride filled with vampires, werewolves, and a velvet-voiced David Warner who curates this awesome sampler platter of nightmares perfectly. The rental cover promised a horror sampler and it pays off like a trick-or-treat bag. A bite of a werewolf, a sip of a vampire, a dash of Marquis de Sade. Every vignette is a mini midnight movie, and as a teen I loved the choose your doom gimmick, and now I admire how Hickox keeps the pace snappy and the tone playful without softening the teeth of the horror.
Cup of coffee, we'll talk about it.
I want out of here, Sarah. I'm serious.
Getting scared?
Zach Galligan brings plenty of post-Gremlins charm, Deborah Foreman is effortlessly engaging, and David Warner is the perfect velvet-voiced ringmaster, all great for the needs of this roller coaster ride of horror and nostalgia. Now, why does Waxwork earn its cult status? I think it's essentially an anthology without the wraparound drag. It's high concept with low rules and a finale that turns into a monster mash barroom brawl. Now, this was a go-to Friday rental simply because of the cool box art and that it had the guy from Gremlins in it. Fun fact on this relic, Hickox reportedly hammered out the script extremely fast and doubled down on all the practical gags to stretch out his budget. Its success on video would spawn Waxwork 2, a time-hopping sequel that would keep the museum doors open a little bit longer, and as for Waxwork's pop culture imprint, it would teach a generation of kids that museums are just booby-trapped movie sets, and it's still a killer palate cleanser mid-marathon, like flipping the channels between monsters without ever leaving your couch. Camp Arawak, a shy Angela played by Felissa Rose endures bullies while accidents turn murderous and secrets simmer beneath the marshmallows in 1983's Sleepaway Camp with Jonathan Tiersten and Karen Fields added to the mix. This is a slasher campfire tale that ends with one of horror's most freeze-framed finales. Now, this was the whispered "you gotta see it" tape when I was a kid, one of the first of its kind for me that was kind of passed around with warnings not to spoil the thing, and on my first watch with friends, their older brothers, and their friends, naturally, the off-kilter vibe just hit the hardest. Awkward humor, mean-spirited bullies, and death scenes that felt viciously personal. On rewatches, it kind of revealed a weird, sticky charm. Felissa Rose's haunted presence, Gould's legendary performance, and just a camp atmosphere that's equal parts mosquito bites and horror menace. Why this movie sits near the summit of cult classic mountain? Well, it's not just the ending, which you should never spoil, it's the movie's scrappy authenticity. The movie kind of feels like real kids at a real camp where the adults are useless and the danger is random, and that rawness just kind of made it a sleepover staple and a late night conversation starter for years. Sleepaway Camp fun fact, the finale involved a custom mask and a body double to achieve that indelible final image, one of the truly great freeze your living room moments in VHS history. And as for its pop culture imprint, beyond the twist, Sleepaway Camp would carve out a lane as the gritty cousin to the glossy slashers. For Halloween lineups, it's the unsettling pivot where the jokes get quieter and everybody scoots closer to the back of the couch. Decades after wartime heartbreak, a masked killer returns to a small town graduation party, stalking students with military precision in The Prowler from 1981, with Vicki Dawson and Christopher Gautman trying to survive a night where silent shadows and Savini-level gore do all the talking. The first time I watched this movie, it was way too late at night and I was way too young to be watching, and I quickly learned that Savini-grade gore and silence can be scarier than loud in-your-face spectacle. The Prowler is all about the atmosphere and impact. You get long, anxious stalking scenes punctuated by brutally convincing kills. Zito's patient direction and Savini's practical effects really make it feel just meaner than most 80s slashers. It's much less roller coaster and much more a master class in foreboding uneasiness.
They never found out who did it. But it had to be someone in town, someone who knew that she was called Rose. And Mark, that guy still might be around here.
Now, why does The Prowler live in cult classicville? Well, it never became a mainstream slasher hit, but devotees over the years have passed it along like a dare, like you think you've seen Gnarly? Well, try this, and on tape. It was the grim counterpoint to all the party slashers, and that seriousness, I think, made it more memorable. It's a story about a Dear John letter gone wrong in all the best ways for slasher fans. Fun fact about The Prowler, Tom Savini considers some of the effects in this movie to be among his best. There's a shotgun gag that'll have you hitting the rewind button, and a ton of other delightfully gruesome kills. And as for its pop culture imprint, the movie's Rosemary's Killer alternate title floated around through rental lore, and its reputation for unflinching FX kept it booked for October marathons as the don't eat during this one slot in the movie list. When a meteor cracks open and oozes an acidic pink nightmare that devours a California town, it forces rebellious teenager Kevin Dillon and waitress Sonny Smith into unlikely hero mode in 1988's The Blob, a remake of the 58 film that melt expectations and everything else in gloriously practical fashion. Now, this was our watch for the effects pick, and damn does it deliver. Phone booth implosion, sink drain meltdown, kitchen ambush, it's all practical artistry that still shocks. Russell and co-writer Frank Darabont really built a mean, witty remake that just gleefully subverts who lives, who dies, while Shawnee Smith becomes the surprise MVP final girl. As a kid, it was a fun monster flick, and as an adult, its tight scripting, its gnarly gags, and sly jabs at authority give it a lot more added depth. Why does The Blob earn its cult status? Well, it underperformed theatrically, but conquered on video because everyone told everyone you have to see the kills. The creature is both nostalgic 50s remake and cutting-edge nightmare fuel. So in other words, it's a perfect Halloween crowd pleaser.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
Fun fact about The Blob, the film's groundbreaking goop and melt effects would come from a killer crew of practical effects workers, including Tony Gardner's team, the same group behind films such as The Return of the Living Dead and Army of Darkness. So the result here is a mix of miniatures, puppetry, and on-set rigs to create that hungry, shape-shifting mass. And as for its pop culture imprint, I think it's another of those movies you remember seeing at the video store 1,000 times, even if you never watched it, simply because of its box art and in a Halloween stack. I mean, this is your fireworks show. Gasps, terror, groans, more terror, then applause, then rewind to do it all over again. Inside of an abandoned church, a priest and a team of grad students, played by Donald Pleasance, Lisa Blount, Jameson Parker, and Dennis Dunn, study this swirling green canister that may be the key to an ancient, anti-cosmic evil in The Prince of Darkness from 1987, a science meets scripture flick with a side of apocalyptic doom. I first saw this one on late night cable TV by myself at home, the lights off, the volume low, every shadow in the house suddenly feeling suspicious. And this one, Carpenter goes full existential dread. It's the second installment of his apocalypse trilogy. You get dream broadcasts from the future, equations on chalkboards, and a creeping siege constantly lurking in the backdrop. It is the slowest burn in this lineup, but the payoff is just a mirror slick chill that lingers after the end credits roll.
What is it?
A secret that can no longer be kept. It started a month ago.
What started?
The blend of theology and quantum weirdness just felt brainy when I was a kid, and to be honest, I had no idea what this movie really was about back then. I enjoyed it, but now though, it feels much more prophetic, deeply unnerving. And why is it a cult classic? Well, naturally, it wasn't an instant popcorn hit, but the patient, oppressive mood of this movie did grow a devoted following. And on VHS, it was the intellectual scare, the one that you discussed after the credits to flex that inner film critic inside you. A Prince of Darkness fun fact, Carpenter actually wrote this one under the pseudonym Martin Quatermass, a cheeky nod to Nigel Neal's Quatermass tales that would actually inspire the a science meets supernatural vibe of this movie. As for its pop culture imprint, it's a bit more obscure. The Tachyon Dream broadcast became a recurring nightmare template. Alice Cooper's unforgettable cameo turned alleyways into boss fights, and overall, this is one to place later in your marathon to let the gloom soak deeper into the night closest to the witching hour. Here, a cute archaeological find multiplies into wisecracking gremlin knockoffs who treat a small town like an all-you-can-eat snack bar, with Harvey Korman stealing scenes twice in our bonus 11th rental Munchies from 1987, a goofy late-night creature feature that feels like a horror comedy fueled by Saturday morning cartoons. We gotta end the night with a wink, and Munchies is just fuzzy drive-through creature comfort, not scary, but unabashedly rental era silly. As kids, we watch this between scarier picks to catch our breath, and as an adult, it's just a nostalgia milkshake. Hirsch, also an ace editor, keeps the tone bouncy, keeps the pace swift. Harvey Korman hams it up like he's been waiting his entire life to argue with himself. The gags are dad joke goofy, the puppets do cackle like chipmunks on espresso shots, and that's exactly the point. How it earns some cult status? Well, Munchies is Roger Corman adjacent mischief, a title tailor made for video store end caps and the perfect one more tape rental at 1 a.m. before the store closes.
Palmon's rough.
I haven't done anything yet.
Munchies fun fact, director Tina Hirsch had cut films for Korman in the past before sliding over into the director's chair for this film, and overall, I think her work keeps the low-budget chaos very snappy and very breezy entertaining. Munchies is another movie with a quieter pop culture imprint. It's the comfort dessert of 80s tiny terror cinema, and proof that the VHS era loved a knockabout knockoff almost as much as a late-night burrito run. And that's a wrap on our haunted midnight rewind through the aisles of the video store. These 80s cult horror gems might be a little bit cheesy, might be a little bit spooky, and sometimes downright ridiculous, but that's kind of exactly why we love them. These are the movies that helped build our Halloween traditions, that fueled our nightmares and turned VHS nights into lifelong memories, whether you caught them on cable, rented them with friends, or stumbled across them while doing some late night channel surfing. Regardless, they're proof that Halloween just hits different on VHS or late night cable. So if you had fun on this nostalgic trip, hit like, subscribe, let me know down in the comments what some of your favorite 80s horror rental movies were, and remember, keep your flashlight handy, keep your popcorn close, and never ever fall asleep first on a sleepover, because here at Movies Never Say Die, the horror never starts rolling until after midnight. Thank you guys so much for watching. Your viewership really does mean the world to me. I appreciate each and every one of you guys. I hope to see you guys back in my next video coming next Friday. And until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
Trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?